Tonight, I'm happy to welcome back to our store Naljorpa Ogyen Dorje and Nyokma Zerme Drimed from the Aro tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. They specifically requested to come on this emotionally charged day of September 11th, and they will be talking about form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Thank you very much for coming this evening.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
We'll start by singing the seven-line song. And you're welcome to join us. We'll do it several times so you pick up the tune.
Thank you.
Again, shall we introduce ourselves first?
Sure. Thank you all. Thank you all for coming tonight on this sad anniversary. My name is Urgyen Dorje. The Naljorpa in front of my name describes my ordination in this lineage. I am a Naljorpa because I'm a man, and if Zerme was a Naljor, she'd be a Naljor Ma. But that's why our robes are slightly different. My ordination is a traditional tantric ordination within a lineage of the Nyingma school. I've been a Buddhist for about 23 years now and counting, all within the Nyingma school, several different lineages.
I'm Nyokma Zerme Drime, and I've been practicing one form of Buddhism or another since 1980, which makes it 28 years?
Mm-hmm.
28. Yeah, I have that problem too. I actually started out as a Zen student, but I am now also a practitioner in the Nyingma school, and hold a Nyokma ordination, which is a different, slightly different one, but held by the same Lama, or both students of Nakchang Rinpoche and Khandra Dechen, who are English people. They live in Wales and hold a Nyingma family lineage.
Our different ordinations don't represent different ranks. They're just different styles, different flavors. Emphases within the traditional Tantra.
So we should say that if you have any questions while we're talking, just please haul off and ask. Our Lama always likes to say if you're bored during a talk, it's your own fault because you didn't ask any questions. And if that's true of him, it's definitely true of us.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so much that we begged Jim to let us talk tonight, as he offered us a couple of evenings in September, and we were both intrigued by the notion of considering the infamous September 11th date and the event that happened from the point of view of Buddhism. And what struck us both at the time and since is how much the events that happened on that day open up the book of the Heart Sutra for us. And the Heart Sutra is something that is pretty much shared by all schools of Buddhism, at least Mahayana. Do the Theravadins use the Heart Sutra?
No, I don't know.
Yeah. I didn't think so. No, it's a Mahayana sutra, but that's a lot of the schools of Buddhism. And the Heart Sutra says, begins with and then elaborates on for actually rather a short time for a Buddhist sutra, the following statement. Form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. Form is no other than emptiness. Emptiness is no other than form. And then it goes on from there, but that's the nut. And those few words were what started me on the path of practice myself. Something about that turning inside out of the two aspects of reality, emptiness and form, turning them inside out, turning them into each other, was completely intriguing to me immediately. I had to know more about that, which one only knows by practicing meditation of some form. So that's what I did. And that's why I'm sitting here, ultimately, because of that attraction to those incredibly packed few words. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Form is no other than emptiness. Emptiness is no other than form. And since we landed on September 11th to be sitting here in this beautiful store, we thought we'd talk about that. The thing that I discovered on September 11th, 2001, was how Buddhist my perceptions had become over the 20-some years I had been practicing at that point. Because when it happened, my response was so sort of 90 degrees off from a lot of responses of people around me. It was part of how I realized maybe my mind had changed some. I'm sure that if we could spend a happy several hours sitting in this room telling each other all about how our day was that day. I have not met anybody who was conscious that day who can't tell you in fairly sharp detail a good bit of what went on that day. I mean, more so than an ordinary day, say. I mean, I can still remember what we had for dinner the night of the day that John Kennedy was shot. Now, I couldn't tell you what I had for dinner a week ago, but I could tell you what I had for dinner that night. And a lot of people have those kind of memories around September 11th. I happened to not have the news on that morning. Didn't turn it on until I was about to leave for work, 8:30 in the morning in California. So it was all over before I heard about it, which means I got it in this long stream of images on the TV. You know, Carl turned the TV on, actually, my husband. And, you know, it was like, oh, somebody did something to the Pentagon. Oh, look. Oh, they flew a plane into the Pentagon. Oh, wait, now it's New York. Wow, they flew a plane into the building. Oh, they flew a plane into the other building. Look, the first one's falling. Now the other. You know, it was just this kind of unrolling of events. So I got it all at once. And it was like a hole was blown into reality at that point. It wasn't just the news. It was just a sense that, you know, everybody talked about of the world being turned on its head. You know, all the people who blather on about, you know, oh, you know, the world will never be the same. But there was that experience at the time of time stopping, the mind stopping, because something had happened that completely pulled me out of my habitual hamster wheel. You know, getting up, getting ready, going to work, this and that. I went ahead and got in the car and went to work. I didn't realize till I got there that half the other people didn't show up, that this was such a big deal, that people weren't coming to work and stuff. It set everything on its ear. But for me, I was just fascinated with the way that those buildings fell down. This was like the first thing that struck me. You know, was looking at these great buildings, which I knew fairly well. I've been in New York and been around them. They were enormous buildings, gigantic, huge, and they just came down and they weren't there anymore. It's a very simple thing, but it completely blew my mind. And it took me a while, I have to admit, to then go, oh, there were people in those buildings. And start to think about all of the consequences. But the first hit was just watching those buildings disappear. And then I got online and played those images over and over again because I couldn't believe it. You know. And then after I believed it, I still couldn't get over how the buildings just fell down, gone, gigantic buildings. And it struck me that as horrible as this may be to say, that people hate this kind of thing, but we also kind of like it. You know, there's a sense of attraction to it. You know, people at work talked about it all day. Nothing new happened, but all day, around and around, everybody remembering what happened and where they were and on it went. And I would have to admit to myself that I had a fascination with it, and that everybody around me looked to me like they had a fascination with it. And what fascinated me was that moment when form became emptiness. The form of my ordinary day turned into something else. The form of those buildings disappeared. And did people see the film that came out, oh gosh, it might have been almost a year later, the two French filmmakers, brothers, who were in New York and filming a fire company at the time that had was involved. Did people see this movie? Because they were French, they didn't get spectacular with it. It was very simple, but they were there. They were in one of the World Trade Center buildings as the firefighters were going on up the stairs and before it fell down. And then when the buildings fell down, they got out and they had their camera rolling the whole time. The guy had a camera on his shoulder through the whole thing. And what was so striking to me as I watched that was the way in which people would sort of roll into the situation saying, yeah, I know what to do. You know, the fire people, they're very well trained. They know how to deal with an event like this, or so they thought. And they'd go in there with their competence, and they're going up the stairs, and they're doing this. And then one by one, you could see their faces start to go blank. Like, this had gone beyond what they understood, what they knew. Various things were happening that I'm not going to describe because they were too horrible. And you could see them deal and deal and deal and then stop being able to deal with it. So that it was the same, that there was just a sense of knocking open the sense that I know what's going on. I understand everything. I've got it in control. I've got my arms wrapped around reality. I understand what's going on. It's all familiar. And that gets blown open. And then there was noticing all of these little details, like in the film, while, you know, these horrific things were happening and the firefighters are sort of all kind of coming to a stop, and before the buildings fell down, there was this beautiful ray of sunlight shining into that lobby. It was a gorgeous day, people might remember, you know, blue sky, sun. And in all the pictures, there's these two buildings and this columns of smoke and a clear blue sky. Vast blue sky around it. And people I've talked with who were there have always will talk about these little things that they remember, like a display in a window just down the street from the building or something like that. The sense that people's sense perceptions were opened by this experience of having life turned upside down, that in the process they remember things like what they had for dinner that night, which is not something you would normally retain. Or, you know, you notice things like the sunlight shining in. Or, I remember the sunlight from after the buildings fell down, too, you know. You could see the smoke starting to rise, and as it settled, it went from being gray to the sun shining again. And that stuck in my mind. And then there was this sense from all kinds of people of an outpouring of warmth and caring for each other that seemed to happen all over. Everybody, I felt that way. I wanted to call up all my friends and relatives and make sure, you know, everybody was okay. And there was a lot of talk about that. And of course, in places where there was need for outpouring of human kindness, it came. So that something about that crack in the fabric of kind of normal life allowed out all of this heart from people as well. I remember talking to you that night. Yeah, we were going to practice that night or something. I think we were practicing on Tuesdays at the time. Mm-hmm. And same thing. Hi, Ergen. You okay? Yeah? Okay, good. How about you? You know, and people were doing this kind of all over the place, just checking in. You okay? You know. So something about having our minds blown like that kind of lets out all this other interesting stuff, like warm human heart and caring for each other and wanting to give, wanting to help.
You could see that from around the world too. You know,
yeah.
Countries that had previously been antagonistic to the United States were suddenly very willing to help and very generous with condolences and acts of kindness.
Yeah, in a way that they haven't done before or since. You know, it was a limited thing. And then it was a couple hours later, a couple hours after I became aware of what was going on. I remember this exact moment when one of the talking heads slammed the lid of interpretation onto it. Because up until then, it had been what a filmmaker friend of mine calls raw footage. He called it footage rather than footage. Just stuff happening, just pouring out at us, and no interpretation. You know, for me, there was several minutes where I had no idea what was going on. I'm just seeing this series of images. And even after someone said, yeah, this happened, there's this sense of just being wide open and not trying to decide what it is that was happening there. And then along came, what's his name? I don't remember which one it was. Who said what?
Peter Jennings.
Who was Peter Jennings? Okay. And he said, do you remember what he said?
Something like, you know, this is no longer a law enforcement situation. This is a state of war.
This is an act of war, is what I remember him saying. This is no longer a something or other. This is an act of war. And you just, bam, down comes the lid. On go the labels. On goes the interpretation. And it has rolled out from there, you know. Though the interpretation, what we made of that, then became a series of actions. And if you've been into an airport in the last six years, you know what the way that things have changed because of how that was interpreted. Because of someone saying it's this and this and the box is built around it, and now we know what it is and we will do things. So this is, as someone who is interested in form is emptiness and emptiness is form, this is very interesting to me, this whole process of seeing the lid blown off, seeing what happens when the lid gets blown off, and then seeing how it comes back down. Because as a practitioner, what I see us doing as practitioners is trying to find a way to find that open place without having to blow up a couple of buildings is really what it comes down to. Without, because people can, these kinds of states are available. We're human beings, we can do this. But in the ordinary run of things, it's very happenstance happenstantial, that's not a word, but I just made it up. You know, it happens here and there. And it happens when we have big disasters, when we have earthquakes, and when we have wars. I've given up on trying to figure out why we have wars. I think people like it. You know, why do people do this? But it does. It blows things up. You know, blows things open. And I think as practitioners, what we want to do is find a way to live in that open place nonviolently, without aggression. In other words, we don't start by somehow exploding our worlds. I mean, it can be much smaller than blowing up a building. But if we come at wanting to change ourselves as an act of aggression, then it's going to be limited. What we want to learn is how to open that space up and walk into it. How to live there. And I think that a key to that is the sense that we have to live with the fact that it opens and closes and opens again. It's like breathing. That the fundamental aggression we drew is trying to keep it. You know, we got it, we know what it is. So that even with the states of fundamental openness that we experience, we then try and put them in a box. I understand now. I've got it. And of course, then it just runs through our fingers.
I was reflecting on that, the initial formulation of form being emptiness and emptiness being form, and realized that the more apparent is that form is emptiness, because things wink out, disappear, fall out from under us, confuse us all the time. And what's harder to conceive is that emptiness is form, aside from smacking the lid on things and imposing form on emptiness, because we can't have it. What do either of you have to say about that?
Well, in a minute, I think I should hand this off to Ergin, because he's the emptiness
half
form
the
half. I'm doing the form as emptiness half. But I want to say one thing. Do you garden?
Pardon?
Do you garden?
Yeah.
You put a seed in the ground. There's a teeny bit of form, but not a lot. And it becomes a plant. To me, that's emptiness is form.
So possibility manifests into particulars.
Yeah. And there's also the sense, though, that the whole thing is not separate, too.
My wife, Yitzel, who you know, once asked me a long time ago, she was having trouble understanding emptiness, energy, and form, or, emptiness, visionary, energetic sphere, and then manifestation. And she said, you know, could I explain that in a non-technical way? And she's an artist, so I thought, well, emptiness is where your ideas come from. Who knows where that place is? It's just elsewhere. The ideas come, but we can't put our hands on the place that they came from. And then when they're cooking around in your mind, it's like, I could do that. That's the visionary sphere. And then she's a customer. When they're hanging on the rack, that's form. And she was able to grasp it, looking at it that way. And all of us experience that, you know, whether it's making dinner or writing a book or making a painting or composing something or, you know, encountering a problem at work and figuring out how to solve it. All of us make emptiness into form all the time.
Well, your grandchild appears.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed. Yeah?
Yeah.
one of the reasons that 9/11 was attractive to us as a vehicle for coming to talk to you tonight was that I know that I know exactly where I was and what I was looking at and which direction I was facing and what was in my hand when I heard that news. And you probably all do too. Just like you, I remember where I was at 3 years old when we heard the news that John Kennedy had been shot. But even at more so, more vividly as an adult, I remember exactly what I was doing. I was standing at the espresso machine. I hadn't yet put the grounds in the machine, but I was about ready to. And the radio was right next to me. And I was getting ready for work. And then the wheels came off. Mm-hmm. And that experience is what we wanted to talk about tonight, because it's so powerful in terms of being a practitioner in this sense of the Heart Sutra, in the sense of the way our lineage in particular looks at practice and looks at our lives as humans and especially as practitioners. The moment of the bottom falling out of our predictable day brings with it an incredible vividness. That emptiness appearing does something to our awareness, and all of a sudden form is enormous too. We can remember minute details that I can't remember from this morning because of the enormous explosion of emptiness with something that changes our perception like that. Now, in the same way that we as a country have gone on from that experience with a vengeance to try to shore ourselves up, or I won't go into details, and it's certainly not a political talk, but we've gotten very motivated as a country since 9/11 to make sure that that big explosion of emptiness doesn't happen again. And this is exactly the same thing that we do as people day in and day out. The Buddhist analysis is that we are form addicts. We like form. We find form reassuring. In the tantric sense, we have a fivefold spectrum, which we use to talk about this symbolically. All the lineages have some fivefold, whether it's the kleshas or whatever. But in the tantric lineages, we talk about the elements. And we say that according to the five elements, we want to be and always reassure ourselves that we are, or try to obtain, solid, permanent, separate, continuous, or defined. This is the fivefold realm of form. And so emptiness threatens us, challenges us, inspires us to get motivated to try to find or create experiences which we find solid, permanent, separate, continuous, or defined. Actually, any one of them will do. As long as we can find something that is definite, immutable, no gaps, or has a quintessential definition that is irreducible, we love that stuff. That's form. That's the monopole of form that we can then identify with and say, ah, yes. If I can have it, if I can see it, if I can experience it, then I'm that way too. And the Buddhist analysis is, well, those aspects of form are genuine and real, but they're not permanent. They're solid, permanent, separate, continuous, and defined, do not exist independently. They're also not solid, impermanent, not separate. These are the emptiness qualities of form. So the Buddhist analysis is that samsara, how many have heard this term or have an understanding of what that means? Samsara, korwa in Tibetan, literally means going around in circles, this cyclic attempt to create this firmament, this solidity or definition. And we are forever trying to change the appearance of emptiness whether fast or slow or anything in between, large or small, into experiences that do not change. Either we have a soul that doesn't change. Even if we can't experience it, we rely on that idea. Or a creator that is unchangeable. This is an analysis that Buddhism rejects. That forms arise independently. They're dependent on each other. And none of them are ultimately permanent. So, as people, as form-addicted people, unenlightened people, we are trying all the time, struggling to create this permanence. And this is what we call the engine of samsara. This is the motivator at the middle of this cyclic struggle to be happy, which is based on a falsehood, which is that form is solid, permanent, separate, continuous, and defined, and so never succeeds. Even if it does succeed, it's not permanent. You know, we often talk about this in terms of an object. Our Lama is very much interested in the fire element, which is the separate in this spectrum. And it's always the fire element is interested in consummating these longings. You want to merge with something, as opposed to, say, the earth element, where you want to just have as much as possible. You want to have mass. Yeah? But he likes to talk about wanting this fabulous object and the delicious anticipation that this is the one. This is just the most fabulous one I've seen, and I collect these things. I know this has the qualities that really are going to just be it. And that as you get closer and closer and closer to obtaining it, it gets more and more flaming fabulous. But as soon as you have it, it's you. It's no longer this object of your fascination. You have it, and so it becomes part of the problem. It becomes part of this empty thing that you're always trying somehow, subtly, to fix up, to shore up. You know, the earth element talks about territoriality, and you don't feel safe. You feel that your form is eroding rather than feeling that there's a separation, as with the fire element. You feel that your mass is eroding, so you want to get more. But Rinpoche talks about that in terms of, well, that just makes your frontier bigger, so you're more vulnerable. It's the engine of samsara is in getting what we think we want to get or need to get, we create our own failure. It's in the system because of our misapprehension that form could be permanent. Yes.
For somebody who is seriously interested in tantric practice, could you speak to the importance of the realization of emptiness within that practice? Is it the kind of thing that should one realize emptiness prior to embracing form, or is, you know, something like that?
The base of Tantra is emptiness. Mm-hmm. Tantra doesn't function without emptiness. If you don't have the experience of emptiness, then you either need to practice the sutric, the renunciate path, in order to apprehend emptiness, or, as is, I'm sure you know, the traditional starting point for tantric practice is the nundro. And the nundro, the preparations for tantric practice, lead you quite strongly and directly to the experience of emptiness. But tantric practice, where you embrace form in any one of many forms, most typically the yidam, but there's also the meditation deity, but there's also music and talk with all the sense fields being available for tantric practice, not just visualization. But none of those practices function unless they can appear on the empty mirror. Yeah?
So emptiness is foundational. It is.
Now, that doesn't necessarily mean the immutable realization of emptiness, but it means you have to have glimpsed it. And you have to have been able to relax, at least temporarily, in being not solid, not permanent, not separate, uncontinuous and undefined. You have to be able to recognize that I, me, this whatever it is that's at the center of the spider web of the sense fields, that is empty. As many features as it seems to have, as much continuity as it seems to have, that it is empty. Yeah? Did that answer your question?
Yes, it did.
Can I add something
sure.
to that?
Mm-hmm.
It isn't just that it's a requirement. Quite often you'll hear people talk about the question you're asking, like, oh, well, you can't do that until you've seen emptiness. You know, sort of like a curriculum. And it's what's happening is that until some experience of emptiness kind of knocks the walls down, we don't actually experience our sense perceptions directly. It's all mitigated by interpretation, you might say, or by that sense of you know, I want this object, but I don't even see it. All I see is what it reflects back to me about me. And what happens when the walls get blown down is suddenly you really see it. And that's when practicing with the sense perceptions actually becomes possible. And it, like you said, it's not like it has to be permanent, because it can't be. But there has to be some sense of that for it to be possible, or for you to even want to. The fact that it's interesting to you means something about your mm-hmm. experience of emptiness. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
You have to have been able to relax in it. Because all of us experience emptiness. It's either so fleeting because of our aversion to it that we skip right over it and deny that we just experienced it. Or, you know, even every day we experience emptiness falling asleep. But even that process, it's... There are practices of dream and sleep where you watch yourself, watch your aggregation dissolve. And I can't do that. You know, one minute I'm awake and the next minute I'm gone. And I have not been able to watch myself dissolve in that practice. We're very adept through lifetimes of practice at not perceiving emptiness. But then, of course, you know, we do see it all the time, and it doesn't have to be 9/11, where two of the most solid-seeming objects and 3,700 people disappear from one moment to the next. You know, it can be very small. People also know that they need emptiness in spite of this compulsive recreation and shoring up all the time of the sandcastle of form. You know, people go fishing and they sunbathe and all sorts of other activities, quote, are as close to inactivity as we can get. Mm-hmm. We just have this most minimal definition of what we're doing there. It's just interesting to look at our experience and see how we accommodate reality, the reality of emptiness. Yeah? Are there other questions? Is it clear why we thought September 11th would be fruitful? Interesting is maybe not a polite word for an experience like this.
I think it's interesting.
There's power.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is the engine of samsara clear? How going for what looks like what we want creates exactly our failure? It's one of the most powerful understandings I've experienced as a practitioner in terms of not getting myself into more complication. And because, you know, the Buddhist analysis is that we're form addicts, but it's a distortion, that we are form and empty. Yeah? So samsara is constantly being recreated. If we just stop doing it, it doesn't happen. We are, in terms of the inner tantric analysis, we are enlightened beings and always have been. But we are disconnected from that fact, and we recreate our misery because we misapprehend the empty component of our experience.
I heard a quote from a tantric teacher one time, mm-hmm. and he said that you can't really have a deep appreciation of emptiness until you've lost a loved one.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just reflecting on that in the context of what you were saying in the death of my father in 2007, and it happened to be an event where the family was able to be with him the 2 weeks before he died.
Mm-hmm.
It was an incredibly intentional event, and the way that we handled the body after the death, and you know, were present with the cremation and handled the bones after the cremation, mm-hmm. and things like that, were all this extended embracing of form becoming emptiness. And I find that when you open yourself up in that way, even in an apparent tragedy, that it's actually that passing, that movement is poignancy itself, and it's actually a very beautiful aspect of human experience. So I wanted to invite you to comment on the nature of death, particularly as we experience it with loved ones and people close to us in this ongoing discussion about emptiness. Mm-hmm.
It's an experience that brings us very quickly back to appreciation, which is perception of form, you know, the form striking the fibers of our sense fields. Yeah. It makes us immediate. Several people in my life have died. And I still remember, you know, co-emergent with the pain, a certain sweetness, mm-hmm. an appreciation that what is still here is precious. You know, the people that are still here. You often see, if somebody's died, as with 9/11, suddenly their enemies are waxing poetic about their great qualities and, you know, it was all a joke we had after a couple of beers. This wasn't really enmity. Yeah, you see people eulogizing the dead, whereas when they were alive, it was quite different. And I think a lot of that is genuine. People suddenly appreciate. Yeah, is that speaking to what you?
Well, sure. I didn't have a particular direction, but just wanted to hear your reflections on that theme.
The other thing that comes to mind is for a joining point of emptiness and form, it doesn't get any better than love. Because, you know, you have the openness and the vulnerability and the rawness of caring about somebody, of loving someone, of them, you know, being part of you and knowing that they're going to die.
The risk of losing them.
You know, it's guaranteed. You know, a person, or even, I mean, I have to say that the most recent loss I've had like that was a cat. But I found myself thinking, I'm not getting any more cats. No more animals, no more pets. They die too much. It's, you know, you want to shut it off. You want it to be one thing or the other.
You can get your dead cat clone now.
Yeah.
So that you have, it's not the same one, but it looks just like him.
Loving dead pit bull, so.
Mm-hmm. Loving somebody, you know, is as good an emptiness and form example as I could come up with. Is it just have to have them both? You can't say it's this or it's that. And, you know, I'll get another cat, I'm sure. You know. just because otherwise things are too dry. You know, people try and cut themselves off from love because of the pain, but the pain and the pleasure aren't separable. Mm.
And the death of someone or some kitty isn't just loss of that person or that relationship, but immediately we know it's us too. Mm-hmm. That we are not solid, permanent, separate, continuous, and defined. We're going to go. There's all sorts of mythology, depending on your religion or your philosophy, about what happens afterwards, but we don't know. It's, as far as we're concerned, you know, it's empty. We don't know. And that makes us very immediate in those times. And I still remember what the plate of shepherd's pie that was in front of me when I got the phone call that my dad had died. I still remember what it looked like. I still remember the china it was on. Are there any other questions or comments? Would people like to?
So the desire for something is what creates the circumstances under which, if you achieve it, you are then disappointed? Is this what you are saying?
Well, it's the desire to make something, and by that I don't mean an object, I mean an experience, something in the sense fields, and that includes conceptuality. Because conceptuality can be the biggest form matrix of all. It doesn't have to be an object. We can be as locked by conception as by anything else. It's the desire or the impulse to make that thing, that experience, into something it isn't, which is what it is not, is solid, permanent, separate, continuous, or defined. It's to make it enduring. It's to deny its empty nature. That's the problem. There's no problem appreciating things or even wanting them. But it's denying that they are empty that gives us trouble. For example, I'm appreciating her scarf more than she is right now because I can see it. And she can't, unless she looks down. So in that sense, I own that scarf because it's in my experience now. And she can say, but this is mine, I'm going to take it home with me, and, you know, it was kind of creepy how you were looking at it, so I'm going to put it in the drawer. I'm not going to take it out, I'm going to keep it safe. Mm-hmm. And that whole attempt to make it permanent is different than just the raw appreciation of its features. That doesn't mean she can't have that experience, of course. But the attempt to make it permanent, to own it in an existential sense, is the problem. Our Lama talks about something he heard once, which is apparently true, is that very wealthy people that have fabulous jewelry will put it in a safe so that it's protected. And then they'll have the jeweler make a paste copy, which they wear to parties. Mm-hmm. So they know they own it. It's back there, but they're not even experiencing it. Is that answering your question? It has much more to do with establishing a relationship with me, with this object or this concept or this experience, than it does the object. We're always relating these things we want to try to get or make happen to what it's going to say about me when I've got it. We're always trying to make the territory safe because then I'll be safe. Mm. We're always trying to get the fabulous object and merge with it because then I'll be shining like a diamond or whatever it is. Yeah? Yeah, am I?
I think I get the idea. It's okay. The attachment part that's the
problem. Yes, that's one way of talking about it, although Vajrayana Tantra doesn't tend to talk about attachment as much because of the base of emptiness. But attachment is very much a sutric way of looking at it. Yes, that's the problem.
You're like attached to an outcome.
Oh, sure. And, you know, you can have, you can be a monk or a renunciate and be as firmly mired in form addiction as anyone, because I own nothing. I'm a perfect renunciate. That's just as bad as William Randolph Hearst. It's just as bad. It's just as entrapped. It doesn't have to be objects. It can be a status or, you know, identifying with anything, really, in that way.
So would that be a problem with meditation when you think you're going to get somewhere doing it?
Sure. Now, you know, everybody needs motivation. There are bazillions of methods for starting where we are, where we find ourselves. You know, even if we're talking about Tantra, where we embrace form, we have to get to the base of emptiness. So everybody practices renunciation. Sure.
It's like it's a gotcha. You know, we whatever kind of motivation we have that we start practicing, at some point that kind of falls apart. You know, because it goes from being the motivation to being a solid, permanent, separate, continuous, defined reason for me to do this. And then it becomes dust. And then we find out why we're doing it again, and then that becomes dust, and there's this constant turning of the wheel.
I mean, this has been said so many times, but it's, you know, the result of meditation, the purpose of meditation is to see the process in action, not to get something or somewhere. We recognize, and that recognition of how we recreate samsara moment by moment is the key to its undoing. Because once you've seen the process arise, you see how it's not ultimately fruitful. And you also see the space from which it arises and recognize that that's okay. And in fact, if you can embrace that, it makes all of our sense experiences much more delightful, because they're clean. They're as they are. They're full blast. They're not filtered through this kind of wretched sieve of trying to manipulate them into being something that they're not. We allow them to arise as they are, but then we also allow them to disappear as they are. But there's no other way. And seeing that process in action is practice by whatever method.
I was going to say, one thing I've noticed is that even if someone's motivation to begin meditation practice is completely misguided, you know, like I want to start meditating because I want to force myself to be peaceful and kick out all these bad thoughts I've been having lately and squelch all these bad emotions I've been having. If that gets them really motivated to practice, even that misguided motivation is not a problem as long as they're willing to let their motivation change. So it seems like as practitioners, we constantly have the wrong idea about what it is we're doing. It just gets a little more sophisticated as the misinterpretation gets more sophisticated as we go along. So it seems like the misinterpretation or the misguided motivation is not necessarily a problem as long as we're willing to let it morph or dissolve or turn into something else.
There's a story from one of the sutras, I can't remember which one, where the Buddha says, you know, well, I'm going to teach in one of the heavens today to his cousin. Would you like to come? The cousin says, oh, sure, wow. So they go to this heaven, and the Buddha says, well, I have to go over here and do what I'm going to do, and you need to stay here, and I'll come back. And the cousin sees these fabulous maidens, this whole crowd of maidens, and he walks over to them, and he says, why are you ladies here? And they say, oh, we're patiently waiting for the Buddha's cousin to be reborn into this heaven so we can consort with him. And so he immediately goes back and becomes a fervent practitioner. And, you know, after how many umpteen years, he's asked, the Buddha asks him about the maidens, and he says, oh, you know, I'd forgotten about them. You had a question that I don't think I answered, or
no, you
got to?
Spoke it. I was thinking about the renunciate.
Oh, wasn't that good of me?
Whose form?
How lucky!
Attachment was to the idea of himself as the perfect renunciate, having nothing.
Sure.
As an example,
impeccable stature.
Conceptuality really is kind of the subtlest.
That's for sure. Yeah, because how is it to leave things undefined? That takes a lot of non-effort. Yeah.
I really like this saying, "Don't believe everything you think." So
that's
it sounds
for
like
sure.
You're in the same wave.
Oh yeah. And you know, thinking's really useful. It's great stuff. You know, you can make buildings and water systems, and you know, you can really be effective with thinking and making. But that, it's so easy to get self-impressed by that. You know, look at the people that have billions and just want a little bit more, you know. I mean, it's a strange thing. Yeah, just, and I'm not talking about people that want more to give away. That I think that's very noble. But you know, you see lots of people out there that want more just because more is better, and that's weird, don't you think?
Well, just reflecting on that, it sounds like they're hungry for something that they think they are not. Like they're missing the picture of themselves.
Well, it's like our dear governor said once. He said, "I know that money doesn't make you happy. I wasn't any happier when I had 60 million than when I had 55.
And this huge wave of sympathy came up.
What a popular.
I can understand how emptiness is inherent in form, how form comes out of emptiness. But I'm trying to understand how there couldn't be emptiness without form. It seems to me there could be emptiness without form. So that's sort of what I'm trying to work through right now, is that I can see how form comes out of emptiness, and emptiness is inherent in form.
Mm-hmm.
But couldn't there be emptiness without form?
I think not. I think in these teachings, which is all I know, I can't answer that because I don't know.
Uh-huh.
Within the teachings and sense of reality from practicing that I have, those are not separate. We pull them apart so we can talk about them. But the whole point of the teaching, the whole point of those things pointed at each other is that they're not separate. That you can't have one without the other.
Yeah.
You can't have light without dark. How would you know that it was dark if there wasn't light?
How would there be anything to be conscious of the emptiness if there were no form?
So it.
Well, just it was emptiness knowing itself. It seems possible. But I think of the atom, when you were talking about emptiness and form, I think of the atom as being, having a form and yet being space, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think.
And yet space and emptiness may not be the same thing. But it seems to me there can be space without any form.
I think we have to be very careful in the West, because we're so sciencey, of getting to abstract ultimates.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a realm of exploration. But Buddhism doesn't really get into too much metaphysics, certainly not physics. We're talking about our experience through the sense fields, which are emptiness and form, including the intellect, which is also emptiness and form. And as a person apprehending absolute emptiness, what are you teetering on treacherously on the edge of? If you've got absolute emptiness, what is it? It is solid, permanent, separate, and defined.
It's form.
It is? Is that how emptiness is defined?
It's absolute.
Well,
because I thought you were saying emptiness was the opposite of all.
That's what I'm saying. Uh-huh. We're always, even in the most subtle sense, trying to create that permanent moat.
So you're saying absolute emptiness would be creating form.
Permanent.
You've called absolute emptiness.
And again, I'm saying watch out for physics and metaphysics, but if you look at experience, yeah, the experiential attempt at absolute emptiness is treacherously close to form.
It's absolute form.
Okay, it's hard for me to wrap my mind around.
Mm-hmm. Actually, the thing is, you can't.
Just unwrap your mind
around. You know, you can experience it in a breath. But wrapping the mind around it is not worth the effort.
And there certainly is the possibility of quite extensive experiences of emptiness. That's for sure. But the arising of form again is inevitable.
Because what is that? In quite extensive experience of emptiness is what? And how does that manifest?
If you could describe it, how could it be the emptiness?
Because you're defining it, right? You're defining.
What I'm trying to say is that it's
sorry.
it's a concept, and that's a form.
The point that was the dilemma I was in just a moment ago, and it's not resolved. What is the difference between the concept of emptiness and emptiness?
The concept of emptiness is a form, because you're grabbing it and putting it in a box.
Right.
I have the concept of emptiness. The experience is something else altogether.
It would seem to me that it's ineffable. How could you describe it as soon as, at least when I think about, if I were to try to describe something that was totally without limits, boundaries, characteristics, I would be silent.
Yep.
And?
And what's the problem? No. I'm just saying that as soon as we get to talking about emptiness, we're putting language, concepts,
this limitations on it. This is why the sutra says form is emptiness and emptiness is form. It's because you can't pull them apart.
It's almost like a koan. You
know? Oh, yeah.
It is a koan. It is absolutely a koan.
It boggles your mind. Mm-hmm.
Then that's the idea.
I keep thinking of the Tao that can be spoken without the Tao.
Yeah.
Directly to what you're going to say, Carl.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're very subtle and tricky about it with ourselves. You know, we can talk about that which fits in here and say that we're, you know, apprehending emptiness. It's very subtle stuff that we do. In order to make emptiness into form.
But every time you are disappointed, you experience emptiness. It is not woo-woo. It is very direct. Mm-hmm. Every time somebody dies that you love, you experience emptiness.
You're surprised, too.
Mm-hmm. What?
Every time you're surprised.
Every time you're surprised.
Every time you see a joke.
Yeah.
And every time you start to speak and you don't know where the sentence is going to end up,
mm-hmm.
That's emptiness. You know, if you watch the words come up, where are they coming from? You kind of create this vacuum that you need to say something that makes sense. But we don't know where that stuff comes from.
There's a hand over there. Mm-hmm.
Would you say emptiness is a lot more like listening than speaking?
But yes, but listening can be quite form captive too. Because if you're conceptualizing, you know, and maybe there's a difference in between hearing and listening. Mm. But speaking, sure, is formulating ideas.
And yet it comes out of emptiness.
Sure. Hey, Jim, you've been trying forever to to say something.
I was wondering if in your tradition you did analytical meditation on emptiness, like if you take an object like a chair and you try and find anything in the chair which exists separately, and you apply yourself to that contemplation, you can't find it separate, and that unfindability is.
There definitely is that in Vajrayana because it's not completely separate from Mahayana, but our lineage in particular is utterly, utterly essential.
Utterly essential.
We have no sadhanas, we have no texts. We have songs, we have practices, and the framework for them, which is certainly conceptual, but all of our application is as minimally elaborate as possible. It's a very female-based and oriented lineage, and in the tantric scheme, that is the empty side of the equation, not the form side. So we have no elaboration where we can avoid it. And that's not because somebody sat down with a pen and paper and designed it that way. It's a terma lineage which comes directly in vision, and that's the whole package. All the practices in a terma lineage will be like the other ones. They have a flavor.
In a lineage like that, mm-hmm. What kind of emphasis is placed on the relationship between the teacher and practitioner?
It couldn't be more crucial. Mm-hmm. Because there's no support from the texts, because mm-hmm. there are no texts. So it is all transmission and instruction, and instruction always comes from the person of a person. Do you know what I mean by that? Mm-hmm. Not directly from the instructor, just through the vehicle of a person. But in Vajrayana, the personality of the teacher is important and is a vehicle of transmission. So in our lineage, it couldn't be more critical. It's said that the lower the tantra, the higher the throne. Right? So there are traditionally six levels of tantra. The more outer the tantra, the more at the Kriya tantra level, the higher the throne, the more distant the teacher is, and the more iconographic. And our lineage is from the opposite end of that spectrum. It's based in Dzogchen, which is the last of the tantras, the sixth of the six tantras. And is very essential, and at times the activity of the Lama is indistinguishable from what other people are up to. It's very subtle. The Lama is not put on any kind of a pedestal. But that means that transmission happens not only in specified ceremonies, but all the time through all sorts of interactions.
That's the point of interest.
It's the tricky part is that you have to be on your toes all the time. You have to be always ready for transmission. It's not going to happen Friday night at 8 o'clock, because that's when the big ceremony is going to happen, although we have those too. But it is always now. and it's very easy to miss it because the activity of the lama is not necessarily, quote, specialized. He or she talks about movies or dinner or takes a walk or guitars.
So is there a strong importance placed on the on being in the physical presence of the lama then?
So that yes. It's also said that the quote higher the tantra, but the more inner the tantra, the less students a teacher can manage, because the relationship is more intimate. Our lamas have limited themselves to 84 students. But they're teaching other students to become lamas in their own right, and so it you know, our lineage grows laterally rather than vertically. Mm-hmm. Are there other questions, comments? Now would be the time to throw the eggs.
Is meditation an important part of your
practice? Oh yeah. But again, the method of our meditation is very essential.
It's sitting meditation and working with the breath and the thoughts. It's not, for instance, a sadhana text and a visualization and a bunch of hand gestures and all of that. It's sitting, mostly.
Most
variants in terms of how we work with the practice, but the practice, this is what they mean by essentialized, is that it's simple. But there's a lot packed into that simple practice.
We have, you're familiar with Yidam practice. You know, tantric practice is often, quite commonly, you know, a text with a description of the deity, and the text goes through in a very methodical sense the construction of the deity and the deity's mandala or environment. The deity has a mantra, and the mantra is repeated, and the deity is visualized, and it's quite a package. And we do have Yidam practice too, although without the sadhana text. But the core and the center and the periphery of practice in our lineage is silent sitting and very essential silent sitting. We, even within sitting, some people have quite definite and complicated methods of bringing your attention back to the present, and ours is as subtle as it possibly can be.
Just before everyone disappears for the night, I realize maybe I should announce that one of our two lamas, Nyokchan Rinpoche, is actually coming to give a public weekend teaching in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's the first weekend in October, and it will be happening at the Omni Karate Dojo in San Bruno, right near the San Francisco airport. And probably the best way to get more details about this, given the fact that I didn't bring any brochures, is check out our website, which is www.arotair.
No, it's arobuddhism.org.
Arobuddhism.org, excuse me. So it's A-R-O.
Buddhism.org.
There's an events menu. Rinpoche will also be teaching at Open Secret in San Rafael on Tuesday evening, the 7th of October.
Could you say that again? I didn't
know. Our Lama will also give a one-evening bookstore talk in San Rafael at Open Secret, October the 7th.
Mm-hmm. I think the weekend in San Bruno is like the 3rd to the 5th, something like that. Mm-hmm. And the topic... Anyway, it's whatever that weekend is. Maybe it's the 4th through the 6th.
Tuesday's definitely the 7th.
It's the first weekend in October. And the topic will be birth, death, and dream yoga.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. That was wonderful. A wonderful way to memorialize 9/11. Thank you for letting us do that. If you like, I encourage you all to visit the website, arobuddhism.org. I spend time there now and then. And it's very good teaching, very rewarding. It's beautifully designed too. Whoever is responsible for that,
David.
And we have some books on the table from the Aro tradition, related books you can take a look at. And one announcement I want to make is this Saturday we're having our tea tasting here. Mm-hmm. And the tea tasting is called Tea is Mostly Water.
Water is mostly tea.
I was getting into that, yes.
You have learned and well.
We will be brewing some tea in different kinds of water to show you the effect that has on your cup of tea. So tea tastings are a lot of fun. It will be 3 p.m. right here. It's very relaxed. You get a chance to sample, a bunch of teas for free here. It's a lot of fun, so I encourage you.
The person I'm teaching this weekend in Santa Rosa, and the person I'm working with is here. Could she announce what we're doing?
Announce. Is that you?
Yeah, that's me. Well, this woman has another name. And she's also very experienced teacher in the Shambhala lineage. And so I went on to the Shambhala Center in Santa Rosa, and we're having a level one, which is the basic level of teaching, and Jill is the teacher. And Friday night is an open public talk. Anybody can come, and it's in Santa Rosa at the between 8th and 9th Street, Davis Street, which is the west side of the highway. You can just ask me if you want to know. And it's an introduction to meditation, if you would like to learn to meditate. And it continues into the weekend with talks and practice and a chance to dialogue along with the teacher and have a discussion group. Also good food and company. So if you're interested in that, I'm glad to tell you more about that.
Thank you. One last announcement. The Many Rivers Books and Tea has adopted the Buddhist custom of dana, or generosity. There's a donation ball on the counter, and any amount that you can contribute will be gratefully received. A portion of the donation goes to our speakers to support their sangha and their work, and a portion goes to the store so that we can continue to hold events here in Many Rivers like this.
Keep the lights on.
Keep the lights on. So thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.